Blog Talk Radio.
You could ask yourself questions. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you? This is Movie Geeks United. How's everyone out there doing tonight? My name is Jamie. We're joined tonight by fellow Movie Geek co-hosts Jerry and Aaron. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
The opening was a little truncated there, just in case anyone out there wanted to know. The remainder of that quote there is, you punk. There
you go. I think I could have figured that out.
I didn't want anyone to feel like you were missing out. We got a great show tonight. In honor of the upcoming DVD box set Warner Brothers is coming out with that includes all of the Dirty Harry films, I think that's this Tuesday, correct, Aaron?
That is
correct.
Yeah, we are conducting a very special segment on the Dirty Harry films with a critic that means a lot to all of us. His work over the years has been just phenomenal and a part of all of our lives, David Edelstein, and we're going to welcome him on in just a few moments. I just want to give you guys an update about what's upcoming on Movie Geeks United. We got some great shows coming up. Wednesday night is our two-hour tribute to Sidney Lumet. And anyone that knows our programming, those tribute shows tend to be real highlights. And this time it's no exception. We have actors like Chris Sarandon and Colm Feore and Kelly Masterson, screenwriter. Joanna Rapp, we just spoke with her yesterday for the show. She's the editor of Sidney Lumet Interviews. We've got clips, analysis. It's a big play-by-play of Mr. Lumet's extraordinary career. It's going to be
a phenomenal show.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And the next Sunday, we're welcoming Chris Lemon, who just wrote a book about his father, Jack Lemon, and that's going to be a great conversation as well.
Yes,
one of our favorites. And then on June 18th, we're planning, in conjunction with Aaron here, a nostalgic look back at the summer of 1983, where we saw some really kind of interesting, diverse films, and some films that meant a lot to us in our adolescence too. And to look back on them, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be enlightening and just a ton of fun. We'll have some special guests on that show as well that we'll announce in the weeks and days upcoming. So you guys ready to get started with tonight's show?
Yeah, I've been ready.
Okay, let's do it. Our first guest has been a film critic for nearly 25 years. He began as part of the generation of young movie critics who cut their teeth at the Boston Phoenix during the 1980s with critics like Stephen Sheff, Owen Gleiberman, and Charles Taylor. He would move on to The Village Voice and New York Post until 1996, where he came into his own as film critic for the online magazine Slate. For 9 years, he has been one of the leading critical voices of the internet age. He is now lead film critic for New York Magazine, where his blog The Projectionist can also be found. He is the movie critic for NPR's Fresh Air with Terry Gross and can be seen on CBS Sunday Morning. Please welcome a man that means a great deal to all of us, Mr. David Edelstein. Mr. Edelstein, are you with us?
I am. It's a great honor, and thank you for checking out all those credits. I'd forgotten about the New York Post myself.
We're honored to have you.
Thank you so much for being with us. I'm going to turn the table here to Aaron, and we'll start our Dirty Harry conversation.
Okay.
Hey, David, how you doing?
Hi, Aaron. Great to talk to you. Were you even alive in 1983? I was
five.
You were five? Wow.
I was going to be 5 years old.
Great. I was 13.
Yeah. And I'm sure we won't get into it, but I almost swear I could have heard your eyes rolling when we announced our Sidney Lumet tribute, but...
No. That would be Armand White, I think, talking about.
Okay.
I was wondering why you don't have Armand in, because, you know, Armand is pretty fearless. I mean, if Sidney Lumet were there himself, you know, 80-whatever years old, Armand would go like, so why do you make such crappy movies anyway?
You know what? We had
David.
We had Armand on for the Brian De Palma tribute show, so we've already been there, done that.
Okay, but he loves De Palma.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, that was safe. That was a safe bet.
Yeah, for the most part.
For the most part.
That's right. I'm sure part of our – I love – by the way, I love Armand. He has no bigger fan, but Armand – the trick to understanding Armand is that you have to understand that for every review, he's either got to talk about how the clueless – you know, critics missed this genius, or the clueless critics, you know, didn't recognize this genius. It can never just be the thing itself. So anyway, none of us understand Brian De Palma like he does.
Excuse me, David. That means I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. I missed a lot. I mean, I just really, I missed the subtext. I missed the whole, like, the homage to Billy Wilder. Okay, but it's beside the point.
Okay. Yeah.
But here, let's get to
Let's
Dirty
get to Clint Eastwood, yes.
Okay, let's get to Dirty Harry. Clint Eastwood, but Dirty Harry in particular. And like Jamie said, there's this massive box set that is coming out because I guess it was finally time, both regular DVD and Blu-ray, and it's kind of the final stop on Dirty Harry and home entertainment. And it's a pretty remarkable box. I've been going through it for the last 2-3 days, and there's just documentaries on the violence of the film, the politics of the film, and then commentaries. Of course, Schickle, Richard Schickle does two commentaries, one on...
What a surprise.
Dirty Harry and Sudden Impact. And then other... John Milius does a very lively commentary in Magnum IV. So we'll try to cover all this.
For that.
Yeah. So let's start with the first Dirty Harry film. So they... When did you first see Dirty Harry? The original?
Oh man!
What were your immediate reactions?
Reaction? Oh my! Well, okay. I was born in 1959, and
mm-hmm.
Dirty Harry, I believe, came out the summer of 71, and I saw it. Now, if I were my dad and mom at the time, I would never in a million years bring. Oh no! It might have been 72. Sorry, it was 72, and I was already a veteran of The French Connection. So I'd seen all the splatter, and I'd heard all the swearing. And so we went to – but now that I think about it, my brother, who's 3.5 years younger, he was there too.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly don't condone that. As a complete aside, my daughter went to a sleepover party last night. She's 10, and they watched Juno. And I practically marched over there and strangled the mom because that is – I don't care if it's PG-13. If she were going to see Juno, it was going to be with me. Anyway, I saw it. I'm not going to say literally blew me away because it didn't literally blow me away, but it metaphorically blew me away. I think if you were around at that time, there was you have to understand it, and you should, by the way, read Jay Hoberman's great, great book. The name of which escapes me. It's so great. In which Clint Eastwood is on the cover with his big magnum. I'm looking back at my shelf here, where it is somewhere. It's a book about the here it is, The Dream Life. Movies, media, and the mythology of the 60s. Well, you have to understand that we're coming off a period in which. There's Easy Rider. There's the counterculture is in full bloom by the time of 1971. But Nixon is in office, and Nixon has this law and order platform. And there'd been Gimme Shelter, and everything had gone bad at Altamont. And don't forget the Zodiac. Now this generation is up to date on what was happening in San Francisco. So all of this stuff came together in the air, the Nixon Law and Order platform, the rage against the hippies, the presence of the Zodiac. So they just decided that they were going to – and the Miranda laws were relatively new. They came about in I'm not a legal scholar, but I think it was 65 or 66. So there was this idea that liberal judges were coddling criminals, the hippies were showing a slightly more malevolent side. Dirty Harry came, and it was absolutely shocking, stunning. I mean, even those of us who liked hippies, who were sympathetic to the movement, just there was something about that white male with his big magnum, his big long magnum, saying, you know, my favorite line in the movie is when he's in this tunnel and this kid comes up and tries to mug him, and he says, "Oh, go away. Get the hell out of here." And the kid was like, "Come on, give me your wallet." And then he pulls out this giant gun and says, "You don't listen, do you, asshole?" And that's my favorite line. I think Milius
right.
wrote that line. That's
yes,
forget the you know, six shots or five. That's one of the great lines in the movie. "You don't listen, do you, asshole?" And of course only Eastwood could say it. It was a devastating movie to see then. I mean, the first half of it is much more brilliant than the second half, because the politics really come in the second half, and it gets very convoluted and very, I think, pretty far-fetched that this guy would be allowed to go free and nobody would notice him on the street but Harry Callahan. You know, I mean, don't forget, the Berkeley professor comes in and says, "You don't have a case, you didn't read him his Miranda rights, you didn't have a search warrant. So you went in there and you stomped all over him," and then he's let free, and it all happens in a vacuum. Now, that's an incredibly distorted way to present that. But it didn't matter, because when you were sitting there watching, you wanted this guy to die. You wanted him to die in the world. You wanted him to die like you never wanted anybody to die in your whole life. And when he got it at the end, I don't remember how many times Harry shoots him, but you know, it felt like he emptied his clip, even though he probably only shot him once.
Right.
It was the most amazing moment. The entire theater went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very long answer to the fact that I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I saw it. My dad took me back. It was rated R. It didn't matter. I saw it three or four times in the theater. I memorized it. I loved it. I loved it. I was, of course, rather oblivious to the politics of it.
Right. It is funny you bring up, you say that the first half is better than the second half, because the film really has its kind of, I guess you could say, climax, if you will, when Harry steps on the wounded leg. The gun.
That's correct.
That is the real catharsis of the film. And then you do get this now infamous Berkeley scene, which is, I just reread Pauline Kael's review, and so we'll bring this in real quick.
What a coincidence. Me
yeah.
too.
And she really dissects this scene, because obviously she was from San Francisco.
Well, let's step back for just a second there and say that what you saw, if you were watching the movie, as far as everybody in the audience was concerned, the movie should have ended there.
Right.
You know, it was very fast. You know, it had all the ingredients of a great detective thriller. He gets there, he finds the guy, he captures the guy. All that was missing was him killing the guy.
Right.
Okay, but you know, the story is essentially over, should be over at that point. And who is going to get in the way of that story being over? Well, who else? A Berkeley professor.
Right. Because Kael shrewdly points out that in a real-life situation, they would have gotten a lawyer from Hastings College, and I think she says another nearby college, but they used Berkeley as kind of a...
Well, it's hard to think that the DA would turn to a Berkeley professor
right,
for advice. I mean, even back then, you would. But you see, let me just backpedal. I know this is endless digression, but if you watch Birth of a Nation, if you go back that far in film history, you understand that the whole vigilante tradition comes out of this idea that the law is essentially throwing up its hands. The official law, you know, force of law and order is just throwing up its hands and saying, you know, we cannot protect you. And this is about we cannot protect you. This is about, it's about Miranda. It's about the perception that judges were coddling criminals and were worried more about the criminal than the victim. Obviously, we see a resurgence of that. You know, that's going pretty strong today with Nancy Grace and Bill O'Reilly and all the kind of lynch mob mentality of Fox News and a lot of
right.
the a lot of CNN. But this, at the time, this was pre-Death Wish, you know. This was pretty unusual.
Mm-hmm. Well, here are a couple of questions that this brings up. One is that, because you brought up the French Connection, and I think the other film that is key in these kind of, I guess you'd say, this type of mood that was going on in the country, came out at the end of 1970, or the summer of 70, is Joe, Peter Boyle, the Hard Hat film.
Mm-hmm.
Another
yeah.
film that kind of has some of the same anger.
Yeah, but do you remember, I mean, I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but do you remember how Joe ended?
Right, Joe. Well, see, Joe is interesting in that it has the rage of these other two films, but it still has that residue of the counterculture.
And the French Connection, too.
Right.
Both the French Connection and Joe ended with somebody killing the wrong person.
Right.
Okay, so even though the protagonists of both films were, in Joe he wasn't precisely the protagonist, but the most powerful figures in both films were loudmouth, vaguely fascist, you know, cops who,
mm-hmm.
who or not cops, or law and order types
right.
who felt that it was...
Well, blue-collar types.
Blue-collar types who felt that lethal force was permissible, given the permissive environment, that they had to stand up and use lethal force because nobody else would to rid society of the scum. By the way, even as I say that, I think how brilliant Taxi Driver was for coming along 4 years later and essentially turning Death Wish on its head and, you know, showing the sort of dark, twisted, psychotic underbelly of
mm-hmm.
that kind of thinking. But yeah, but Joe... Say what you will about Joe and The French Connection, both of which are problematic movies, although I think incredibly powerful movies, there was still a great deal of lingering ambivalence on the part of the filmmakers. Joe ends with, you know, the last person in the world you'd want to be killed
right.
by, you know, a person doing it. The French Connection ends with Popeye Doyle shooting what he thinks is Frog One, and it's not Frog One, it's another cop.
And then we get those final shots off camera, so we
right.
don't even know what happens if he does get the right person.
Well, we know he doesn't because Frog One
right.
comes back in French Connection too.
Right.
I think the final shot that we hear in the French Connection is the ultimate expression of impotence.
Right.
You know, of the cop and that, you know, that music, that horribly unresolved, unsettled, whining music. I mean, it's a lot of people came out of the French Connection very happy because a lot of people had been splattered all over the walls, but not Frog One. So Dirty Harry was a step forward insofar as it gave you the full catharsis, and then some, you know?
What's interesting about comparing French Connection and Dirty Harry, that in French Connection, Popeye's racism is out in the open. He uses the N-word. He uses all the ethnic slurs. And at the time, Roy Scheider, you know, late Roy Scheider used to say, you know, he would go to the theaters and the black audiences or the Puerto Rican audiences would laugh and cheer when Popeye Doyle would use these epithets because they knew that's what Popeye and cops like him were
thinking.
It was the world
that they knew.
Yeah.
It was a different climate because nobody had yet sort of risen up and said, hey, you can't say that.
Right.
It's simply seeing the world they knew was a kind of victory for them, even if the character was, you know, was their enemy.
Which is interesting to compare to Dirty Harry because over the years of the Dirty Harry film, Harry's racial bigotry, maybe that's too strong a word, but racial discomfort is plainly obvious, but he doesn't really use epithets or anything derogatory. It's just more in his accent.
Harry became Archie
Excuse
Bunkerized.
Me.
Right.
Excuse me, Aaron. That's because the great line is the guy says, you know, he hates everyone.
Right.
He's
right.
an equal opportunist. He doesn't.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing.
Right.
And the only if there is a prejudice he has, it was college boys.
Right.
He hated college boys. That was his only prejudice. But everyone, he was an equal opportunist, and that was brought up decades later in Sidney Lumet's Q&A, the Nick Nolte character. He hates everyone.
Right.
Right. But I think he was Archie Bunkerized. I mean, I think there was a way in which he was his bigotry See, the point is, if he's a bigot and it doesn't have any it doesn't have any meaning, it doesn't translate into him, for example, beating up black people in lieu of white people, or bringing a special animosity to hunting down Puerto Ricans or something like that, then it doesn't matter if he's a bigot. The law and order audience can stand that as long as he shoots the right person.
Right.
Right. And well, what's interesting is that, so, and another film that's also around this time that deals with this, and it's a British film, but it also has the same hardboiledness, is the original Get Carter by
mm-hmm,
Mike Hodges,
that's right.
Which also came out around Christmas, fall of 71. So it really seemed to be almost, no one was able to bring it all together, but it seemed that this unease was really just a natural extension of the times. But I'm curious.
Well, it was a backlash against the 60s. You have to understand,
yes.
Culture, it's such a pendular thing. The 70s, on one hand, represented this period of where all the freedoms that were won in the 60s sort of came to fruition. You know, drug use,
right.
Sexual freedoms, feminism really came into its own in the 70s. But alongside it came this powerful backlash, which eventually would manifest itself in the so-called Reagan Revolution, or at least draw its support from the backlash. But we were seeing just the very, very beginnings of that, of that kind of thing. And the explosion, look, there are other vigilante movies, but not very many of them. There was that, what's wrong with me, the Glenn Ford, Fritz Lang movie, The Big Heat.
The Big Heat,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, The Big Heat is a pretty much straight-up vigilante movie insofar as, you know, his wife is murdered and he takes the law into his own hands, and it's you know. But those kinds of movies were relatively rare back then. Usually the protagonists worked within the law,
mm-hmm.
You know, even if they had to fight the law, even if there was resistance, they didn't go outside the law. They didn't, you know, disobey their commanding officers to the extent that Harry would ultimately do. And I think Jim Hoberman, you know, was very brilliant in perceiving one of the strengths of Dirty Harry is that it fused this kind of outlaw mythology with a right-wing reactionary mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Harry became the maverick, the outlaw maverick, you know, who
mm-hmm.
He was hip. Harry was a very glamorous figure, and he was very hip, and he was far more hip than the hippie that
right.
he was going after. He was so much more hip. He was so much more masculine. You notice how Andy Robinson gave that guy a sort of feminine laugh.
Yes,
he wore a peace symbol on his belt, and he had this feminine laugh.
Obvious symbol right
yeah.
there.
And but the feminine laugh, I think, was far more significant than the peace
symbol.
You're
right, David.
And then also the great, you know, the real wink-wink line, he goes, "My, what a big gun you have," at one point. When
right,
he,
right.
When he's beating him up. And the interesting thing about, and Cale pointed this out, and it is very true, at this stage in Eastwood's career, he was all masculinity. There was no sexual component in any of the Dirty Harry films up until the last one. When he's given a female partner in the third one, it's Tyne Daly, who is made up to be very unglamorous and very...
Well, there was no significant
development.
Yeah,
yeah, but there was no sexual vibe there between them whatsoever. I mean,
no.
She could have been a dyke for all, you know,
yeah.
for all anybody.
And then you get into Sudden Impact, which you talk about Reagan Revolution. Sudden Impact is a very interesting film in that it's a film that was greenlit because of a survey, and it was in 83, Christmas of 83, so it's at the peak, we're really getting into this Reagan groove, and
right.
It seemed to strip away any serious pretense of earlier Dirty Harry films and just took it to its barest essence to where
mm-hmm.
It even gave him a female doppelganger, if you will.
Well, Sudden Impact was a cartoon. I mean, we're looking at... When we jump from Sudden Impact to Dirty Harry, Dirty Harry to Sudden Impact, that is a huge leap stylistically. I mean, It's not just that Eastwood directed, it took over from Don Siegel, and Eastwood was nowhere near the director that he is now at the time. But Sudden Impact was very much conceived as a cartoon and functioned, you know, on I think, an even cruder level than Dirty Harry.
Well, what's interesting, the way I looked at Sudden Impact is that the warnings that particularly Kale gave about Dirty Harry and French Connection, the jolts for jocks line that she coined in her French Connection review, is that Sudden Impact is really that film that she was warning us about, more so than Dirty Harry. Sudden Impact is really the film that's just all sensation and just the slimmest pretense of a
well, of course, by then movies had become that. I mean,
right.
When she was writing that review of The French Connection, I mean, that was a very prescient review that she wrote in 71, one of her greatest, I think, in which she said that she feared that movies would devolve into jolts for jocks, and it was really, it didn't happen in the next few years, but it did happen in the 80s. It did happen in the 80s, and certainly I think it's the case now. I mean, it's hard to believe that anybody could. I mean, it's sort of like hearing Eisenhower complain about, you know, warn us about the military-industrial complex. Was there ever a time when the military-industrial complex wasn't, you know, making all our foreign policy decisions? I mean, maybe that was true. You think, was there ever a time movies weren't jolts for jocks? Well, yes, I guess. Once upon a time, that idea was truly horrific, you know?
Excuse me, David.
Yeah.
I have a question. Didn't you think by the time that Eastwood did take over the directing reins of Sudden Impact, and especially with the Deadpool, I don't remember that one that well, but don't you think you already knew that it had become a cartoon?
Well, Buddy Van Horn did the Deadpool.
Yeah, but don't
was,
you think, though, by the time
yeah.
of Sudden Impact, even he knew it was a cartoon?
Yeah, he did, and he did, and I think he brought that to, I mean, he deliberately overheated everything. He barely brought a trace of realism to that.
Even they knew in the script reading that the line "Make my day" was going to become the catchphrase. They knew that from the moment they saw the script.
Well, "Make my day" wasn't really original to that movie.
No.
I mean, I'm not sure about this, but I distinctly remember seeing a real sicko little movie called Vice Squad.
Oh, wonderful.
Back
oh,
in the
yeah,
day with,
Vice Squad, yeah.
And as I recall, remember Wings Hauser?
Yeah.
Right.
I've been looked, by the way, if anybody there knows where I can get the song that he sings over the closing credits called The Neon Slime, I am desperate to the Wings Hauser. But I distinctly remember the bad cop, I can't remember the name of the actors, you know.
No,
telling,
I remember Vice Squad. I
telling him
something.
To, you know, go ahead, you know, come on, you know, take it, come on, make my day, make me kill you, make my day. But, I mean, I don't think that was even the first time, but what Eastwood did was he slowed it down. He would go ahead, make my day, you
right.
know. And it was repeated a number of times, and it became a...
And the president used it.
Yeah, I mean, it was on the same level as Rambo. I mean, the president invoked it in the same way that he invoked Rambo at a certain point. You know, it really was sort of cartoon,
mm-hmm.
meathead, macho intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
What is interesting to note about Sudden Impact coming out at the end of 83, and that is the cartoon that Eastwood felt obliged to do, is that he countered that with something a little more thoughtful in the summer of 84 with Tightrope, which is
a much better film.
A much better film. At least a more interesting, thoughtful film where it's kind of the counterbalance, because it also has very weird sexual politics that Sudden Impact doesn't take seriously, but Tightrope at least attempts to try to...
I mean, in attempts. When I saw Tightrope, I was sort of thinking, what's the fuss about? I mean, Eastwood has made some great films. The Outlaw Josie Wales is a great film, but I guess he didn't direct Tightrope, but Tightrope made gestures in the direction of the idea that the cop could have these sort of sort of twisted psychosexual life that would make him equally as plausible to be I assume we're going to talk about Magnum Force.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the very same idea in Magnum Force, which is that sort of tease that, you know, is Harry Callahan the one who's doing this? You know, is this some force unleashed from his id that's going around killing all these women? I don't think it's really very satisfyingly worked out, either in, obviously, in Magnum Force and not in Tightrope either. But it showed you that Eastwood was maturing, or at least he felt he should mature. I don't know if he was maturing, but he felt, you know, Richard Schickel thinks he was maturing. But,
right.
You know, and bless Richard Schickel. I love the guy. But, you know, he's one of these, he's an acolyte through and through. And in terms of Eastwood, God, you know, he's so brilliant. He's so much smarter with everybody else but Eastwood. But when it comes to Eastwood. But, you know, I mean, Eastwood clearly, you know, at a certain point was wanting to be taken much more seriously as a director, as an artist, and was beginning to introduce dissonances, introduce darker elements. He was flirting. I mean, it really wouldn't be until Unforgiven that he would really begin to flirt with the idea that, you know, maybe there was something wrong with vigilantism and with pulling the trigger. And even then, I think Unforgiven is somewhat overrated as an anti-vigilante
movie. You think it's Mystic River that goes to that point, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Mystic River does, but Mystic River, of course, comes completely from the mind of Dennis Lehane.
Oh, of course.
Everybody's always saying, well, and in Mystic River, Eastwood did, you know, but the thing is that Eastwood just, you know, shot the script.
Right,
And based on the novel and didn't depart from it, but he was attracted to that. Yes, he was attracted to that material.
Well,
he wanted to make an anti vigilante movie,
right,
in a sense.
Because you feel the third act of Unforgiven, it goes back to the Dirty Harry school.
Yeah,
of thought.
Do you know that? How do you know that?
How do I know that?
Did I write that somewhere?
You did write that. You wrote that in 2003 when you were in the New York Times.
Oh my God.
Yeah, dude, I follow you, baby.
David, wow.
I'm your worst nightmare. We've been getting New York Magazine since the first issue, and I've been keeping up with you ever since you've been writing for New York Magazine, but also all the stuff for Slate.
You are my worst nightmare because, you know, it's all self-contradictory, I'm sure.
I will send you, I am large, I can train
multitudes. I've contradicted myself in the last 2 weeks, okay?
I will send you a picture of Jerry so that way you can recognize him.
Great, that's great. Unforgiven is a beautiful piece of work in a lot of ways, and it's a wonderful script, but in the end, you know, it's not exactly like you're in mourning for anybody in the saloon that he wastes.
It's not, these are like, you know, it's like, would you be in mourning for anyone in the Nuremberg trials? Of course not. You know
no,
what I mean?
Exactly. I mean, this is it's really not that much different from High Plains Drifter or from, you know, these other films, that many of which sort of were inspired, that Leone did, inspired by Yojimbo, in which, you know, who cares who dies? I mean, they're all just, as Travis Bickle says, you know, flush him down the sewer.
That's right.
Or whatever he says. I mean, there's a sort of nihilistic component. It's not a, it doesn't, it's not a sort of law and order, strict law and order, you know, virtue triumph. It's a nihilistic component, but it's still very much a kind of a right wing, you know, disgust with, you know.
Oh, of course it is. That's what makes Magnum Force. I like Magnum Force because, you know, like you said, is Callahan the one doing this? But he's like the lesser of the two evils. It's between that and Hal Holbrook's army, which has the guy from Animal House and David Soul in his army, which is I don't know how, if I want to really back that horse or not, so I'll go with
Callahan. You know the thing is, they seem vaguely gay. That's another thing.
There's a whole sub, you know, that movie,
yeah,
game, the whole homophobic thing, because that's like the, Callahan's homophobia is represented in those men.
Exactly. I mean, I sort of think that the subtext of that was that we should really leave law enforcement to the heterosexuals, because the people who are not in control of their homosexual lusts are really going to they're the ones who are going to be the Nazis, be the stormtroopers.
Right.
And then, of course, as we all know, that climax is in The Enforcer when he says, "You fucking fruit," as he like aimed his bazooka at the tower in which the I remember in Richard Schickel's biography. I'm sorry, I hate to pick
I have
on
it right
Schickel.
Here. I have the biography.
He sort of says, in retrospect, Eastwood thinks that perhaps if he had known that, you know, gays would be more respectable these days, he would probably not have done that. I mean,
no, I don't think he would have. He says
it's
as much.
Hilarious. It's really hilarious.
challenge in that. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's a. I mean, Schickel will contort himself all sorts of ways to.
He does. Rereading.
Can I say again? Every time I say something bad about Schickel, I have to say I really like the guy's work, and we just have to. His blind spot, you know. Oh, his loathing of Pauline Kael and his.
He
idolatry and his idolatry of Eastwood. I think we have to correct for those two things and say he's actually a pretty damn good critic. And you know,
we all have those little things that kind of blindside us.
Right, exactly.
I have that with Pacino. I can't tell when Pacino's overacting. I refuse to admit Pacino's not overacting there. No way. But we all have those little things.
You know what? If you had gone to see Salome on Broadway, the stage reading of Salome on Broadway. I swear, Pacino is, I've given Pacino the benefit of the doubt a lot of times, but there's something about seeing him live, seeing his shtick live, that makes you just throw up your hands and say, he's just gone. Whatever he had is long gone, you know.
David, man.
I want you back on the show, but you just crossed the line.
Sorry.
I love you, man. I love you on the show.
Pacino
so has we're not continuing this.
I loved him in Waiting for Richard, and I loved him in the thing with Sea of Love. But you know, Pacino needs a director really badly.
He does. Yes.
Well, here's a question. This is a question I did want to ask on just on a start wrapping this up on a Dirty Harry tangent.
Yeah.
That you know, Godard said that the only way to criticize a movie is to make another movie. And my question is that the Dirty Harry sequence in Zodiac, do you think that could be seen as kind of the ultimate critique of Dirty Harry, the character, and the movie?
In David Fincher's Zodiac?
Right. In that, the one sequence where, you know, they've been exhausted by this case, it's real, we've gotten to know this total grind of police work, and it's coming to nothing but dead end, and he's told to go take a breather, and he's obvious, and Mark Ruffalo goes to the movies, and it's Dirty Harry, and he whispers to his wife, I gotta get out of here, they're making movies about it. And then the capper of the scene is he's outside smoking a cigarette, which is amazing enough in a public place. And someone says, hey, Dirty Harry did your work for you. And Mark Ruffalo says the great line, yeah, so, you know, as long as, you know, you forget due process, it would have been terrific.
Yeah.
It just seems And Fincher said, because he grew up in that era, he said, actually in the commentary of Zodiac, he goes that he always felt a little disturbed even as a kid when he saw Dirty Harry in the way it kind of just blithely kind of took elements from the real tragedy and just really put it in a pop form.
Sure, but I mean, and that's a really cool and funny aside, but you can't say that it may be a critique of Dirty Harry, but which had the greater power? Let me ask you, which had the profound cultural influence? It sure as hell wasn't David Fincher's Zodiac.
No.
I mean, in the end, it's very, very hard to discredit Dirty Harry on the level. First of all, it's a fabulous piece of filmmaking. I mean, Don Siegel was really at his peak there. It's so easy. His style was so easy, and it was so... I mean, if there is any director who was kind of anti-lyrical in all the right ways, it was Don Siegel. That guy really knew what he was doing. I mean, he really did have a kind of laid-back jazz man's way of. I mean, it's no wonder that Eastwood would want to emulate him.
Well, it is interesting to note. You know, if I remember correctly, Siegel was never nominated for an Oscar. But if you look at stuff like Body Snatchers and Dirty Harry and the Alcatraz film, just those three, and his able to not do flourishes, but within
right.
the deficiency, there
no
are
flourishes.
Flourishes.
And yet, the thing is that there's things that stick in your mind. Mm-hmm. There are things I remember. I only saw the Alcatraz movie once when it came out, and it is a superb movie, and it has so little action in it, and yet... You're on the edge of your seat the entire time. I mean, it is Don Siegel stripped down to just the purest Don Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
And he just knows, It's just a matter of constructing a sequence. What mm-hmm. comes first? What comes second? When do you go for the wide shot? When do you go? It's just he had a sort of storytelling instinct that
right.
just translated into the shots, into the order of the shots, into the you know, where the camera was placed. He was a wonderful. I mean, I'm not going to put him in my. Well, I don't have a pantheon, but if I did, I wouldn't put him in my pantheon because I do love flourishes in a director.
Right,
you
right.
know? I'm a sucker for flourishes, but you know, if I want to see, I've been lately watching, you know, a lot more. I've been watching a lot more Don Siegel, Sam Fuller type movies, and you know, and Phil Carlson and people like that, and trying to understand that tradition because it's so antithetical to all the film school graduates
right.
Nowadays who are so into showing you their flourishes. Don't show me your put them back in your pants. Put your flourishes back in your pants, goddammit. Just tell the story.
I guess the final question, we'll try to bring this to current events.
Yeah.
What do you think, has there been a film or any couple of films that have done what Dirty Harry has done? Maybe they haven't reached the zeitgeist that into the zeitgeist where Dirty Harry has, but have taken the archetype of this rogue vigilante cop and really taken it further or maybe turned it on its head. From the one film that I think of that no one probably remembers, there's a 1988 thriller with James Woods called Cop.
Oh, my God, Cop? I remember Cop.
Yeah.
Oh,
really,
Cop was a disgusting, very powerful, disgusting movie. I loved Cop. I remember the very end of Cop,
yeah.
The last shot of Cop in the school gymnasium. Let's not spoil anything, but Cop is a very, you know, is a sort of Neanderthal piece of work, but
it definitely is
along the lines of what you're talking about.
It's almost like they said, okay, let's take Dirty Harry, and what if he's really, really dirty?
Yes, that's right.
And that's
really,
like,
really
James
Dirty
Elroy
Harry.
For
that's
for
what they should have called it.
Right.
That's James Elroy for you.
Right.
And,
but,
you know,
but,
the thing, yeah.
But what do you think? Is Cop or what? I guess the modern one is Training Day. A lot of people throw that out there, but I don't really.
I think actually that the new generation. It's very hard to do. Really, the Jodie Foster movie was the purest vigilante movie I've seen, and there are people who think that's a masterpiece. I was sort of not quite stunned by it, by its crudeness. I mean, I really thought it was. It looked like a 25-year-old movie in terms of its sensibilities, but and in the New York that it depicted. But
mm-hmm.
although it was done from a feminist perspective, although Ms. 45 certainly, you know, had been over that territory before. But I mean, revenge will always be a component of movies. I mean, it was from the beginning. It will be, and darn, it's satisfying when it's done well. But the straight out, you know, anti sort of left wing, the law is impotent vigilante movie. I don't really know. I don't know if there's anything nowadays. I mean, Training Day, the guy was a psycho, and I think that, and even, you know, there was a fascinating line in Batman Begins was all about, you know, will Bruce Wayne become a vigilante or not? And and Katie Holmes, of all people, said a wonderful line, which she didn't say it well, but it was a very, very well-written line about how, you know, justice is about harmony. Vigilantism may enforce a kind of justice, but it doesn't enforce a sort of larger harmony. And Bruce took that to heart and decided that, you know, he was going to work within the law, to a certain extent. He was going to have allies within law enforcement. So I think we've moved beyond that. We haven't moved beyond that on Fox TV, but with Nancy Grace. But I think we have moved beyond that. But look, you know, it'll come back. The pendulum will swing back.
Okay.
Yeah. David, I hate to be the bad guy, but I got to close up the segment. But you are absolutely welcome to come back on the show anytime. We'll get our wrestling gear on.
and we'll go to the mat over Al Pacino.
And listen, can I just say something? Next
yes.
time, interrupt me more, because, you know, I just bore the hell out of myself. So really, let's have a dialogue. Don't let me hold forth anymore, okay? And I'd love to do it. Thank you. Aaron, you're a prince, too. Thank
right.
you so much.
Talk to you soon, David.
All right. Bye-bye.
Right, thank you, David.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye. It's one of our great critics, one of our great thinkers about film, David Edelstein. That was a real joy.
So,
yeah,
it was. Have you calmed down?
Cheated.
Are you calm?
He's calm. Don't you worry about
yeah,
that.
I'm calm. Excuse me.
He took that better than I thought he would.
I'm choking on my rage. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
we're going to bring on Chris. Hey, buddy. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
What's going on, man?
Nothing. I'm just listening to this fascinating conversation about Dirty Harry.
Does anyone else remember the movie Cop? Am I the only
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I do.
James Elroy, but James
yeah.
Woods.
Right.
I think it's badass. I think James Woods is about as that's about as intense James Woods as you can get right there.
Yeah, what about Another Day in Paradise?
Oh, that's well. And we won't give for any listeners for the six of them who are listening right now.
It's more than that.
Okay,
yeah, it's a little bit more than that, Darren.
Go rent Cop. Go rent Cop. It's on DVD. And
is it?
It is on DVD, and it's a 20-year-old movie, but you'll be blown away by the final scene of Cop. It's a truly remarkable
movie. And then go read the book Killer on the Road, I think it's based on, by James
Dolan. No, Blood on the Moon.
Is it Blood on the Moon? Okay, it's Blood on the Moon.
First of all, I want to say, for anyone that is wondering the Movie Geek's take on Sex and the City, and I'm sure that everyone out there is, one of us has seen it.
Yeah, that would be me. And let me
just say,
well, I saw it. I mean, everyone was like, oh, we knew Jared was going to see it. Okay, so I went to go see it yesterday, and I think I was like the youngest one there, a bunch of fucking senior citizens there. So I took my mom. We both were like debating whether we really wanted to see this because the film we saw before this was The Strangers. And I think The Sex and the City was actually scarier than The Strangers, if you can believe that. But
well,
I will say this about Sex and the City. Anyone who gives this year's James Bond film a bad review or gives it shit for product placement should be taken out and shot, because I've never seen a movie that has as much product placement in a single frame as Sex and the City. I've never seen anything like it. It's like a Vanity Fair. The first 200 pages of Vanity Fair is all advertisements. That's Sex in the City.
Actually, the original title of the movie was Sex in the City, brought to you by Chanel. Did you know that? It was amazing.
I thought it was by Mercedes-Benz. Okay.
Or
Louis Vuitton, for that matter. The film could have used some humor, I thought. And if you've ever seen a British show called Absolutely Fabulous, you were hoping to God that Jennifer Saunders and Joanna Lumley would show up. Within any amount of time, because that would have added some.
Chris, do you have any thoughts about Sex and the City?
I
didn't see the movie, although I just was informed my girlfriend was going to see it with a friend of hers. Now her friend is going to go see it elsewhere, so it looks like I might have to go see it in the next.
Oh, you might have to do your boyfriend
duty, man.
Do you
want me to send you some painkillers?
No, I'm going to stop by the store, grab a Massengill and some Pamprin before I go see it, and then.
How about a bottle of Patron?
Yeah, maybe.
We all need it.
I'll fork it up with that. No, I'm glad the movie made a bunch of money because, you know, it's typical that a female-driven movie doesn't make a bunch of money right away. It makes a lot of money over a long period of time, and this is the exception. So I say good for the fans. It makes the fans happy when a movie is successful, and, you know, I think it's a good thing.
Go ahead, man.
I was going to say, I don't know if it'll also have that longevity that female movies typically do, and I think maybe it will, because they want to go see it over and over again. But
I think it's very healthy that there are movies out there for everyone, you know, and that's a healthy movie landscape for me. So on that count, I'm pleased.
No, it's if you like the show, I noticed that the people who have watched the show a lot don't like the movie, because I think it's the running time of the film. Has upset a lot of people. If you're a fan of the show, this is a movie definitely for you. If you like
even though you just said that fans of the show don't like it?
Well, I said fan of the show, but a lot of other fans do, though. But I've talked to a lot of people who, would you just let me finish? I know you're so upset because David Edelstein insulted your idol.
No, you can't.
I know.
All right,
but
go ahead,
I know that you just shit your pants like 10 minutes ago because
It has nothing to do with that. I think you're hysterical, dude. Sometimes when you come out, you end up contradicting yourself. You don't even realize it.
Well, no, but fans of the show that I've talked to aren't crazy about it. But other fans say, "Oh, it's the perfect movie for the."
Yeah,
I think what you're trying to say, Jerry, is if you never were a fan of the show, there's probably a pretty good chance that you're not gonna like the movie.
Yes,
but
thank you.
If you are a fan of the show, there's a chance that you'll be one of the people that really enjoy it.
And even fans of the show like it, of course, but they're used to watching it in 30 minute increments.
Yeah, I think
so,
that's the running time is the big problem for everyone.
Actually, here's my thing on if you're not a fan of the show, you're not gonna like the movie. Chances are, but I think for the fans of the show, there was a divide in the show for those who liked the finale of the show and those that didn't like the finale of the show. And I think that's where it breaks down. And I think if you liked the finale of the show, which I did quite enjoy, I thought it was actually very moving and, you know, it was actually a well-executed into a series. So therefore, I think if you were in the groove of the show's finale, I think you'll just groove right into the movie. But if you didn't like the finale, the way the show finally wrapped up, the movie kind of extends on that, so I think you're going to be a little more disappointed. And
right.
For those who are liking it, from what I'm hearing, the running time is not the factor. I mean, you know, there can never be too much of a good thing for people who like the show. So I think
So I
don't think the running time. I think the running time has been used as an excuse by those who didn't like the show and were dreading having to review the film, or B, by those who just were tired of hearing about it, and that was just one thing that they had a chip on their shoulder going into the screening room. You know,
I'm already tired of hearing about it, so let's go on to the next topic.
Conversation is giving me my period here.
I want to give both of you guys a chance, since Jerry and I will be conducting the Lumet tribute on Wednesday night. I want to give you both a chance to chime in on your thoughts of Lumet, highlights that you see in his career for you personally. And let's start with you, Chris, my friend, my love, my movie geek.
Oh, Jesus. Well, I don't even endless love. I don't even know where to start. Well, I guess you'd start with 12 Angry Men, This guy has been working for 50 fucking years, longer than that, I guess. It's pretty amazing, and it's pretty amazing that he's still making decent movies. Like his last movie, Find Me Guilty, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead was his last movie, but his last two movies have still been, relevant, entertaining movies with interesting performances. He's never been stylistically, he's kind of like a Don Siegel or a Clint Eastwood, like we were talking about earlier. He's kind of a workman-like director, but a solid career that's got some amazing highlights in it. I guess The Verdict would probably be my pick if I had to take just one, because I think he pulled probably Paul Newman's best performance. Probably my favorite performance with Paul Newman.
I think Paul Newman agrees. Paul Newman agrees.
Does he really? Yeah. It's pretty amazing. And just the scene where he walks in and smacks what's-her-name, and it's not just because he smacks her, but there is just so much emotion in that scene with, no words whatsoever. It's a really, really awesome movie.
We're going through his catalog, and there's like little movies that meant a lot to me that time has kind of forgotten about, like Running on Empty, the River Phoenix, Judd Hirsch, Christine Lottie. I think probably one of his most emotional movies, actually, Running on Empty. And, of course, Network, movies like Network and Dog Day and Serpico, movies that are part of the popular vernacular. They have lines that you can quote that I'm mad as hell, Attica, he's hit that popular culture thing several times. And it's always about character. It's always about performance and story. That's what makes him old school. And he doesn't want to interfere in that. He just wants to bring out the most of it as a director. And that's admirable, especially among today's crop of directors that
feel the need, some of them, not all of them, but feel the need to be the stars of their film. So they make it known that, hey, this is a director behind this movie here. And some of those we like, and some of those we like, a Michael Bay or that kind of thing, we don't necessarily respond to them. I mean, that's the difference between like a Fincher and a Michael Bay, where they're highly stylized, but Fincher's stylistic flourishes kind of bring out the most of the material, where Michael Bay, it's just, you know, it's showing off his masturbation. I mean, I'm sure that we agree for the most part about that from previous conversations we've had.
Right.
Lumet is what a director should be. He's invisible to a certain extent until you look at the whole scope of what he's done and you find these like connective threads and what makes his movies so stunning and high quality. Aaron, what do you think? What are some highlights of his career that
I break it down as kind of like there's some directors you can do like this where it's a decade thing, like Woody Allen, like you can, like what are your, you know, pretending, you know, I kind of do the thing of like Woody Allen, what are your two favorites from each decade, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today? And I think, you know, and you can pick two of your favorites, usually your comedy and your serious one. And I think Lumet kind of works that way also. Each decade, he has his own different theme or just stylistic approaches pertaining to each decade. And, you know, so in the 50s, you have kind of like, he's coming out of that live television generation, so of course 12 Angry Men is probably the, you know, one, he's probably the best at of that generation that transferred real immediately to film, to taking those techniques. Then in the 60s, he really got going with the Longest Journey and so forth. And then in the 70s is his, where he really exploded, you know, talk about Serpico and the Dog Day and Network, but also what's the other one? Is it Anderson Tapes? Or
the Anderson Tapes. Yeah, he did a lot of good stuff with Sean Connery.
And then in the 80s, you know, that's when, you know, these war horses of filmmakers, they really had to find their niche and make their own mark in the 80s. That was, you know, all about the blockbuster and so forth. So you look at, you know, everyone talks about The Verdict and Running on Empty, which are great films, but the lost masterpiece of that film that no one didn't talk about at the time, but now everyone remembers it, is Prince of the City.
Yes, it is a wonderful film.
And then in the 90s, I look, Jamie, you know, I talked about, you know, Night Falls in Manhattan, but I also look at Q&A, which is...
Q&A is an awesome film.
Yeah, great film. And then this decade, you have really kind of this old-timer, really, you know, in the 80s, you know, like an Altman, really kind of, you know, where we've gotten into this bloat of these filmmakers that we were talking about earlier, and you got these old-timers like Scorsese with The Departed or Altman with his last couple movies, like, okay, I'm going to show you how the story can be the star, and you get Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. And so, you know,
Lumet has always returned to melodrama.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at Departed as kind of a melodrama too. Mm-hmm. But Lumet, like every fourth or fifth film, he makes it a point to return to melodrama. And his last one being Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
One of the few smiles that I had all last year was right after Before the Devil Knows You're Dead came out, was reading, I think it was in the trades, the Sidney Lumet, Inc., two-picture deal. You know,
yeah.
And the fact that he's like 80 and he gets a two-picture deal because of the success of Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, to me that was the real reward of that.
Yeah.
Of the whole success of that film.
You know, it's interesting, reading these interviews with him, somebody was on the set interviewing him and everyone involved in The Verdict as they were shooting it.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he's a no-nonsense shooter. He shoots like two takes and that's it, generally, because he goes through 3 to 4 weeks of rehearsal, even still, which is unheard of. So he always comes in under budget. When they caught him on The Verdict, he was a week ahead of schedule. But he had scripts on his desk, and one of them... Obviously, Mamet wrote The Verdict. One of them was another Mamet script called Malcolm X.
Oh.
And that he was considering doing, that he wanted to do. I had no idea Mamet wrote a script for Malcolm X.
What would Mamet's Malcolm X be like?
I do know that. I am aware of that because I have the book of Spike Lee's script and the diary that he kept called By Any Means Necessary. And he took little bits from all the scripts that were going around. The Mamet one was one of them. If I'm not mistaken, I think the Mamet script was about, basically, it was kind of Alex Haley interviewing Malcolm X. I think
right.
that was the angle on it, with this journalist interviewing this radical politician and trying to.
So it's pretty much probably the narration for Spike Lee's Malcolm X came from those discussions with Alex Haley, right?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
If the, what's interesting? Well, let me ask you this, game.
Well, Lumet was supposed to do Scarface too.
Right.
Which, if you think of something like completely outside of the realm of a Lumet film, and Lumet just creatively just wasn't jiving with it for obvious reasons.
From what I understand, I think Jamie can back this up. He's the one that suggested Cuba, making
yeah.
him Cuban. I think that was his major contribution, which is really kind of the thing that really took that film off into a whole new direction. But let me ask you this, Jamie, since you're kind of a resident Pacino expert. You say that Lumet's no nonsense and he's all about 2-3 takes at the most. But he's all about the rehearsal, you know, 3-4 weeks, which we all know that's what Pacino loves is the rehearsal. But how does Pacino, I guess he responds well to the 2-3 takes?
No, Pacino responds well to the rehearsal. I think the brilliance of Lumet is, yeah, he does. His preference is 1 or 2 takes, but he is so good with actors. He knows what they need. He knows how they need to be coddled. He knows what makes them most comfortable to give the best performance.
Mm-hmm.
So he will do. He actually did more takes of that phone call scene in Dog Day than he's done of like almost anything else, to the point of exhaustion for Al Pacino. Like Al Pacino thought he gave all he had, and you could see it on his face. And then Sidney Lumet says, "Okay, one more time." And Pacino looked at him like he was crazy. I mean, this is the guy that likes at least 8 takes to get going,
mm-hmm.
and he's looking at Lumet like he's crazy. But because he wanted that point and that conversation to be the point beyond exhaustion, like something very specific,
mm-hmm.
when he's talking to his wife on the phone after he hangs up with his lover,
mm-hmm.
And you could feel it. That performance is transcendent. And I told you like last night, Aaron,
yeah.
it's this generation's on the waterfront,
mm-hmm.
just in terms of how many actors were inspired to become actors from watching Dog Day. You know, it's like what you hear from Pacino's generation, where they say after they watched Brando the first time in Waterfront, they wanted to do that.
It's just an unfortunate byproduct that one of those actors was Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's perfect.
Can you imagine, there's a Saturday Night Live skit to be done of, like, Charlie Sheen doing scenes from Method movies, you know, Charlie Sheen's take on Dog Day.
Yeah. But Dog Day, and then, Chris, I know that you and I are on the same page, just as a performance, I mean, it's transcendent. You can't get better than that. Chris, are you with us?
I guess we lost him.
I guess we lost Chris.
We did lose Chris.
Where'd he go?
What is interesting, because Chris talked about the verdict being in that verdict being his favorite Lumet, and then being the best Newman performance, and Newman has said that it does seem that the best performances in Lumet films are done by actors who pretty much are in every frame. I mean, you got Pacino in both Serpico and in Dog Day Afternoon. Those are pretty high watermarks for Pacino's career, and then Newman in the verdict. And then, I mean, you look at, you know, Seymour Hoffman in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and you just go on and on where these, I mean, River Phoenix is practically in every scene in Running on Empty, and it's probably his best work. And so that seems to be kind of that running them through the mill that Lumet does with some of his act, it really seems to get the best out of them. I mean, just look at Faye Dunaway in Network. She's pretty much almost in every scene. And
yeah.
It's probably her best work next to Mommy Dearest.
Yeah, I agree. We've run out of time, and mm-hmm. we've run out of Chris. So we will catch up Wednesday night, our 2-hour Lumet tribute. This has been a great show, a nice conversation with Mr. Edelstein.
It was.
And,
wonderful.
Yeah, wonderful. We'll see you guys on Wednesday night. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.